Hi, welcome to episode 25 of the Woke-ish podcast. This is Ebony.
And this is Zelma.
And this week, we are going to be talking about applying to grad school because it's application season. So for all of y'all that are listening and that are considering it or that are applying, we're going to give y'all some information about, you know, our experience and just some things that we've learned over time and, you know, maybe some things that we wish we had done or wish we had known. But before we get there, we will start out with our shout out segment. Oh, actually, I should say, and also some of the things that we talk about for grad school may also be applicable to applying to undergrad or applying to, you know, another professional program or something like that. Yes. Okay. So we'll start out with our shout out segment. And first on the docket is a major shout out goes to Shirley Rains of Beauty to the Streets. Beauty to the Streets is her Instagram handle, and it's spelled beauty and then the number 2, the, and then streets with the Z on Instagram. She provides beauty services for the homeless living on Skid Row in downtown LA. She goes to Skid Row every weekend and provides various hair care and beautifying services. I saw a video of her using a portable salon washing bowl to wash a woman's hair, and another of her dyeing someone's hair. She also styles. She and other volunteers provide food and other resources. And, you know, this is, one, it's a super, like, beautiful thing, like an incredibly beautiful thing, but it's also very critical because in 2008, Habitat for Humanity estimated 1.56 million homeless adults in the U.S. alone and 2.5 million children. And I'm sure that that number has increased dramatically. And, you know, this is a rough estimate since the homeless are a difficult population to count in the first place. And our country's resources and services for the homeless are grossly inadequate. So having someone that's doing things like this, you know, providing a service that, you know, I think that most people take for granted, you know, that we, while a lot of people can just get up and go to the salon or go and get their hair and makeup done, like that is not feasible for the homeless population. Mm-hmm. So shout out to Shirley Rains, who is doing, you know, something super impactful and fulfilling.
Yes.
Yeah, if you're in the LA area, look her up on Instagram, maybe potentially volunteer. She, I followed her. She seems like a really amazing person, and she has a really great and joyful spirit.
Yeah, I also think, doesn't she, like, feed them sometimes while she's doing their hair?
Yeah, so I did see her, I know that she said that she gets donations from people, and so there are people that I guess don't necessarily go out to volunteer, but will send, you know, different products or food and things. And yeah, because she was one of, I guess, her favorite person out there. I don't know if she has favorites, but it seems like this woman might be her favorite. But she was doing a video trying to get someone to donate flowers or seeds for the woman's garden. And so she does things like that, and she uses her Instagram platform as a resource to get, you know, things sent. So people send food or people send money to buy food. And then, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good. Shout out to Shirley.
Yeah.
And then our second shout out is just Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. And we kind of talked about the whole Supreme Court nominee, I don't even know what to call it, circus. Mm-hmm. But last week, if you were following, they had the testimony of Dr. Ford and of Judge Brett Kavanaugh. And I just wanted to shout out specifically Dr. Christine Ford because I thought it was really moving, her testimony. It was very honest. And I think it highlighted a really important issue So she's a research psychologist and a professor at Palo Alto University, and then came forward with her allegation that Judge Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, sexually assaulted her more than 3 decades ago when they were high school students. And we kind of talked about this last week, but in her testimony, she had to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee, which, if you didn't see, was like mostly old white men, about the allegation for hours. It was so long. And I felt, from my opinion, because I watched her testimony, remained composed and answered all questions, even when I felt some of the questions were asked intentionally to discredit her. Like, they seemed to be just badgering her to the point where they wanted her to, like, get flustered or her to, like, stumble on her words. But I felt that she responded to everything, like, very, like, bluntly and honestly. And there was even some points where she, you know, because she's a research psychologist, used some of the more, like, technical terms to describe why her memory should be credible.
Yeah, like, what kind of question was that? Yeah. How can you trust your memory?
Yeah.
Well, let me break it down for you.
Because they didn't ask that for Brett. They weren't like, oh, Judge Brett, you're saying you didn't assault her.
Yeah.
So how do you trust your memory of what happened 36 years ago?
You have this history of drinking, which he tried to, you know, skate around.
Yeah. But what I found really disheartening, but not surprising, is that Trump, in a rally, of course, mocked her testimony, saying that the real victims are the men who are the men when these accusations are made. The good thing is, after her testimony, calls to the sexual assault hotline increased over 100%. But I think it's important to shout her out because with something I learned this week, I actually went to a sexual assault talk here on campus. And I did not know that because of Betsy DeVos, and who was picked by the Trump administration to be the Secretary of Education, they are now making universities dedicate resources to help and support students specifically who are accused of sexual assault. So while I think that it's important to hear both sides, and I do think that there are times when maybe someone is falsely accused, we know that that doesn't happen as often as when there's actually a real assault that happens. But to think that I don't think there's enough resources being distributed to sexual assault victims anyway, but that now they have to set aside by law resources, including lawyers, support staff, for the students who are most often male that are accused. So it's just kind of like, it's important for people like Dr. Ford to come forward so that it kind of humanizes. It apparently, like, she, her testimony itself kind of caused a lot of other victims to come out. And even we were in academia, and what I noticed is I follow a lot of Instagram posts, and a lot of women did their own stories of sexual assault in academia. And not only sexual assault, but sexual harassment, and just like opening up the discussion of sexual assault isn't always just, you know, forced intercourse. Yeah. It can be groping, it can be unwanted touching, it can be unwanted communication, it can be unwanted words, unwanted
sexual attention.
Yeah, and so I think that I wanted to shout her out because it takes, you know, she has gotten a lot of negative feedback from a lot of people. But I also think that what she did was also allow survivors to feel like, you know, they're not, one, they're not alone, and two, it shows people, like, even the most put together person, a PhD professor who's very, you know, well spoken, very intelligent, like, I could tell that she was still very traumatized by what happened to her 36 years ago. And so I can't even imagine the women who aren't in the position of privilege that she's in to have the resources to process all her feelings, to have the support of a spouse, to have the education that she has, to have a job that allows her to feel empowered. Like, there's so many more victims, both men and women, that don't have that. And just imagining, like, how much worse it must be for someone who isn't in that same position. So I just wanted to shout out Dr. Ford, and hopefully, you know, if you're listening and if you're a victim of sexual assault or sexual harassment, you can kind of feel like, you know, I definitely believed her, even if a lot of people don't. And I think that going forward, what I learned from her testimony is wherever I end up, if I end up in academia or as an employer, I always want to victims to know that I'm not going to just make assumptions about why, if they're telling the truth or not, and if, you know, it's just important to be heard. I don't think that Dr. Ford was looking for, at this point, any criminal charges against Brett. I just think she wanted validation. And so just shout out to her, and shout out to all the survivors out there who are every day waking up and keep going, because I definitely was very moved by her. And I even talked about this in therapy, and my therapist said that, you know, he has experience working with sexual assault victims, and he said that from his experience, being sexually assaulted is one of the most traumatizing things that can happen to a person.
Yeah.
And so that has very long-term implications. And so Shout out to her, and shout out to other survivors.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Look at our president.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's no... I mean, obviously, he is in support of Kavanaugh, because Look at one of the biggest scandals that followed him throughout his campaign.
Yeah.
You know, and I also saw his son saying that he's most fearful for his sons because of these accusations. And it's like, well, maybe if you teach your sons to keep their hands to themselves, They'll be fine, You know? And it's, I mean, like we discussed last week's episode, like those conversations are not had with little boys.
Yes.
They need to be taught explicitly in the same way that people teach their daughters, You know, how to avoid situations like this, how to keep themselves out of situations like this. You know, and I think, I mean, when I think about college campuses, like, that's a hot mess. That's a hot mess, you know? And I'm thinking about what you're saying, and it's like, I don't know. Those, I feel like, are the most difficult situations to rectify, because you have, like, I still don't know how I feel about situations where the guy and the girl are drunk. Like, I don't know. I don't think that that's black and white, but a lot of people feel like it is, and I don't.
Yeah,
but it's like, how do you, you know, is it fair to apply these same standards, like, from broader society to college campuses that are really very different in a lot of ways, like the culture, you know? I don't know.
I mean, it definitely opens a conversation for that, and so... Yeah. Hopefully, you know, I was kind of optimistic at the talk I went to, because they were saying that, I mean, they're trying new avenues. I know Columbia, they were saying that at Columbia University, they're using graduate students to do ethnographies. So what that means, in case you don't know, is like you go into a area or a place and you just like observe. And so they collect data. So a lot of these graduate students were just going to undergraduate parties to collect data on like what they saw and bringing back reports. And one of the things that Columbia instituted now is suggestions be based on these observational studies is that if there's a couch in an open setting, like in the living room, it reduces the need for people to go upstairs to a room by themselves to like lay down or like sleep it off. And then in itself reduces the opportunity for someone to be assaulted just by having a couch in open space. And so, and that was through the data from these graduate students. So hopefully this just opens the conversation so that we can ask each other, what is assault? What is consent? What happens when both people are intoxicated? Who can give consent? Who doesn't? What should the punishment be? What do we do? Because, like you said, it's not black and white sometimes. Like, there are some things that are, but there are some things that aren't. And so...
I feel like with adults, especially with sober adults, it's black and white. Like, there's no... It doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't... You're old enough, you're grown enough, you've had enough sexual encounters, I think, or whatever, interactions with the opposite sex to know what you're doing. Now, do I hear... And I haven't heard of anything recently, but I remember when I was in college, like, or even in a few years after, there seemed to be, like, situations, like, monthly where a college athlete was, you know, charged with this or, you know, alleged with that. And I've just always felt like, I don't know how do you make that judgment call that, oh, this student deserves to be expelled because, you know, this woman said that she did not give consent, and he's saying, well, I would, like, we were both drunk. Like, how do you expect for one person to be in their right mind but not the other? Mm-hmm. I don't know. So yeah, I'm glad that Columbia is doing something like that, and I hope that I don't know, Betsy DeVos, this whole administration is just
very shitty.
Like, so I'm like, am I surprised that that's what she's doing? That's what she's using her resources to do? Mm-hmm. Really? Not education, not K-12 education. Yeah. Nope, that's not, but what you're worried about are people accused of sexual assault.
Not school shootings.
Nope.
Accused of, the very few people accused of sexual assault.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like, come on now.
Yeah.
Come on.
And our third shout out goes to the women organizing the Speak Truth Summit, October 20th to the 21st at Chicago State University. And so that is, you know, we know it's pretty short notice, but if any of y'all are in Chicago, the purpose of the summit is to give voice and visibility to not let us as a society forget or ignore any longer how certain systems impact women of color in a disproportionate, particular, and often more severe way. So we actually got sent this invitation. We actually got emailed this invitation from Carla Coop Esquire, who is the Speak Truth Summit creator and organizer. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, we cannot make it, but we really wanted to encourage anybody listening who might be able to make it or who's in the area to, you know, look it up and register. So again, that's this hashtag Speak Truth Summit. It's October 20th to the 21st at Chicago State University.
Maybe it's something that you might be interested in the future, or you might want to look at the women who are involved and see the types of things that they do. So very thankful for this being sent our way. And shout out to this summit, because it seems really great. If I wasn't so pregnant, I would definitely travel to this, but we are not near Chicago, and I cannot get on a plane anymore. But thank you. I know. But thank you for thinking of us. And if you ever have any conferences or summits or organizations or events that you want us to highlight, even if it's not in our area, we would still love to share that with you guys.
So. Yeah, so Carla, if you're listening, thanks so much for sending this our way. We really appreciate you.
You know, as we always say, if you know someone who you think deserves to be shouted, even if you don't personally know them, but find them on Instagram mm-hmm. or something, feel free to send us a DM on our Instagram or our email. We'll give you that information at the end of the episode.
Yeah. Okay, so now for our In the Know segment.
So you guys probably already know that the president, Donald, sent out a national wireless emergency alert test. So if you have a cell phone, you probably received a text Wednesday afternoon around 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This message is the first nationwide test of the system built by the federal government and cell phone carriers to warn Americans of an emergency, like a terror attack or a widespread disaster, or I don't know, to just tap into our phone so that you can, I don't know what they can do, but to me it sounds scary. It sounds like something we should be wary of. Like, why does he suddenly need to test this?
I don't like that he can contact me.
Yeah, like, I don't trust him at all.
I'm afraid it's just gonna be like new Twitter alert or something.
Oh my god, imagine.
No, I'm not down with that either. But a part of me is like, ugh, but what if it does have some importance?
But why would it suddenly, that it hasn't had in all this time? Like, I don't feel like there was, there has not been a time where I was like, damn, I wish I could have gotten that in message form from the president. You know, like, there's never been a time where I felt, like, so uninformed that I needed a text.
That's true.
The Capitol.
Especially not now.
Yeah, it's like, I don't want to hear from you.
I don't.
Anything that you have to tell me, I can see on the news.
Like, I have to work hard not to know about him. And now he's making it harder.
Yeah.
But I did read, like, on Instagram that you can, like, block the notifications on your phone. So
you can't block that one.
Oh, you can't?
No. It's like, I saw, like, a compilation of posts on the Shade Room. And someone went to their, like, notifications. And it says, like, presidential alert, and there's no on-off switch next
no,
to it.
No, like,
yeah, it's
of course.
Like, those are the only ones that you cannot block.
Well, another thing we have.
And that was something that he demanded, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
Like, make sure they can't block me, by the way.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So we'll see what types of alerts this administration thinks that we need via phone that we can't get from the news. I guess because he doesn't trust the news. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it's like, you know, I'm sure that there are people that don't watch the news at all or don't, you know, check into any kind of, like, news media coverage or whatever because they're avoiding it. It's like, now you may not be able to. Now it's like, no, you must get the news.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah, so I don't know how y'all feel about that, but apparently everybody got one, so... People actually were questioning, like, oh, did it go to any trap phones, you know? I don't know.
Ugh. Our second in the know story is a new, well, it's not new for us here in our particular field because this is something that we've known for a really long time, but NPR just did an article about how research shows that where you grow up influences how far up the economic ladder you get, which is not a surprise to us because we know that the neighborhoods you live in reflect the kind of resources that you have at your disposal and the types of networks that you can draw from. But a new online data tool using data from the Census Bureau and the IRS, created by a research team at Harvard University, finds a strong correlation between where people are raised and their chances of achieving the American dream. So that just means that there's a pattern. They found sort of a pattern that where you live impacts how well you do in your life. And so what the main findings they found that I wanted to highlight is that people born in the 1940s or 1950s were virtually guaranteed to achieve the American dream of earning more than their parents did. But that's not the case anymore. For today, for kids turning 30 who were born in the mid-1980s, only about 50% of them go on to earn more than their parents did, the research shows. So basically, it's a coin flip as to whether you are now going to make more than your parents and be more successful than them. And then, of course, race complicates these findings because for minority children, even if you grow up, so for Black or Latino children, even if you grow up in mostly white and affluent neighborhoods, so if we go by the logic of where you live is supposed to give you better chances of doing well, so if you live in a better neighborhood, then you should have better, higher chances of doing well. But for Black or Latino children, even if they live in mostly white and rich neighborhoods, their chances of moving up in the economic ladder aren't actually better than those growing up in mostly minority neighborhoods or low-income neighborhoods because the social networks that should be helping them get ahead aren't available for them in the mostly white neighborhoods. So for children of color, like even if they manage to get out of these low-income neighborhoods, the people there aren't helping them get ahead. And one of the things we know is that it's not just buildings and schools that help you get ahead, but also connections to jobs, connections to schools, connections to resources. And you get that through friends, through neighbors, through people that you work with. And so even if you move to better neighborhoods, if you're a person of color, they're not helping you.
Yeah.
And so kind of disheartening.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they're... So I've seen a few studies where they find that for Black people in particular, if you grow up in a low-income neighborhood, or Black people are more likely than white people who grow up in low-income neighborhoods to live in a low-income neighborhood as an adult.
Mm.
So it's kind of like a, you know, intergenerational transmission thing. It's like if the resources that your parents are able to pass down to you ultimately influence where you end up.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, what you were saying about networks is so also so critical, right? Because there's another study by this woman, her last name is DiMaggio, and she was studying white folks and their access to resources and how she uses the term hoard resources.
Mm.
And a lot of the white folks that were in this study reported that they got where they were, like, on their own, hard work, blah, 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 no handouts and all this stuff. And then she, as a separate interview question, asked them, you know, how many jobs that they had as an adult had they, like, actually applied for. And none. Mm-hmm. None. Like, all the people in her study had gotten jobs through networks. Mm-hmm. So it was like, you know, their dad knew somebody who hired them, or, you know, parents and things like that, relatives and friends and stuff like that. So it's like, if you don't, like you're saying, like, if you, the issue is that poor Black people tend to also have poor Black people in their networks. Mm-hmm. And I would guess the same for other people of color, mm-hmm, as well. Mm-hmm. Whereas white folks, even the poor ones, tend to have wealthier people in their networks. Mm-hmm. So they may be poor themselves, but they might have a cousin who is doing well or something like that, that can help to give them certain connections or access to certain resources. And so, yeah, I mean, it's... So ultimately, it's not necessarily about class. It's about race.
Yeah, yeah. Because, and why we say that? Because the example of these minority children. Yeah. If it were just about class, then by the sole fact of them being in better neighborhoods, then they should, you know, be getting, be moving up the economic ladder. Mm-hmm. But because that's not happening to them,
yeah,
then we look at, okay, well, then what's different about them? Oh, yeah, well, they are a different race or ethnicity. And yeah, so we talk about this throughout our podcast in some of our past episodes, if you ever want to go back and look at them. And that's something that we'll definitely visit in the future. But just definitely wanted to bring up this new article because it's research that's publicly available. So if you're interested in this, it's available. You just go to NPR. It's an article that was just released this week, and it'll give you the link to be able to, like, look at your particular neighborhood and just to see, like, what your chances are, to look at the economic background of your neighborhood, to look at the racial composition, so you can kind of get a sense of how different neighborhoods look like, and kind of it explains as to why there's such a differences in wealth and in economic mobility among and across race.
Yeah. Okay, and our third in the no topic. So The Atlantic just published an article entitled "The Not So Great Reason Divorce Rates Are Declining." And so a lot of y'all out there may know that people have been, millennials in particular, have been pretty wary about marriage, mm-hmm, just because of the divorce rates of the previous generation. So it was something like 50%, yeah, at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, apparently, divorce rates are on the decline. And they're framing it as a not so great reason, but I actually don't think it's that bad. so millennials, because of, you know, education and, I mean, just individualization in general, and, you know, us focusing on our careers and all that stuff, we are marrying a lot later than previous generations. But because we're marrying a lot later, we're taking longer to scope out the marriage market, right? So we're not rushing into things. We're not marrying the first person that we fall in love with.
Or have sex with.
Yeah, exactly. It's like we're waiting until we're in our late 20s and things like that. And because of that, we're picking people that we're more compatible with. And because of that, we are less likely to get divorced. Because it's like, oh, you know, we have really taken our time to vet, you know, our potential spouses. For those of y'all that don't know, which are probably very few people that do, so my dissertation looks at people's, like, evaluations of marriage, their beliefs about marriage, whether, like, their marriage desires and expectations and things like that. So I read this article, or my friend sent me this article. It's, like, right up my alley. But what I have been told by a lot of people that I've interviewed is that they're nervous about marriage. Like, they still want to do it, but they're afraid because they know so many divorced people and they haven't really seen a example of a successful marriage. And so I just want to let y'all know that there is hope. It's fine to take your time. Don't let anybody rush you. Don't let anybody, you know, make you feel like you're getting old or whatever. It's like, it's better to take your time because then you vet the person. And, you know, y'all ultimately end up being more compatible. If you want to find this article, just one more time, it's called "The Not So Great Reason Divorce Rates Are Declining," and it's online with Atlantic Magazine.
So I guess the moral of our In the Know is, although our generation's more likely not to make as much as our parents, we're less likely to get divorced.
Oh, and I mean, one thing that I forgot to note also is that the people that are most likely to get married are people that are college educated. And so I guess that's another thing that they're trying to highlight in this article is that, you know, the college educated are the most likely to get married for economic reasons, right? Because weddings are expensive.
Yes.
Marriages can be expensive and all that stuff. So people that are on the lower income, who are of lower, who have lower income are less likely to marry. College graduates are more likely to marry, but they're more likely to marry later. So
that explains some of it.
Yeah.
Although our generation is also higher educated.
So that's true too.
Yeah. So some positivity.
Yes.
But
yes. There are a few caveats, but ultimately I feel like it's still positive. Yeah. Okay. So now for our What's Being Slept On segment.
So I strongly suggest that you wake the
Okay, so it's application season, and so we wanted to give a few tips and pointers about, you know, applying to school. Right now we're in grad school, but we've, you know, we've both been to undergrad, been to college, so some of this could pertain to that as well. And yeah, so we just wanted to suggest some things that you should consider before applying, or some things that we wish we had known.
Yeah.
So I guess number one on the list is to apply to the program that you feel best suits you.
Mm-hmm.
Not the program that you think looks good on paper.
Mm-hmm.
So opinions will vary on this, and it's probably, it'll probably vary based on discipline. So I'm thinking, like, you know, for like an MBA or something like that, you know, you might want to just go to the program, like the best program that you get into. But for something like a PhD, it is a marathon, not a sprint. So if all you focus on in selecting a program is how impressive it will look on paper, you're making a big mistake.
Yes.
Make sure that whatever program you enter aligns with what you want to do, because otherwise you'll be miserable. So, yeah, like some of the, so I guess I'll speak from the standpoint of like sociology, right? Because that's the program that I'm in. And so if you, like, some of the best ranked sociology programs are not very sound culturally. Like, you know, and it's because it's like, why? Like, people want to come here. We don't need to make sure that we have the best working culture environment because we're the best. You know, everybody that we graduate goes on to get, like, these super amazing jobs.
Yeah.
Now, that's true, right? But my opinion is that you can go into a program that you're going to be happy in and you can pave your own way. You know, so all the same reasons why people get jobs coming out of those schools, you can make sure that you set yourself up to get a good job coming out of whatever program you decide. So if that means, you know, if you do want an academic job or something and that means focusing on publishing, then do that. Other, and I don't really know, I feel like outside of academia, like if you want like a government job or a data management job or something like that, something in industry, I don't really know that they pay that much attention to what school you come from.
It's no.
Like, oh, you got a PhD. Boom, you're good. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I have heard, now this is not like something that people actually talk openly or explicitly about, but that a lot of the top fives, like say like the, say the Ivies, like they only really hire from one another.
Yeah, yeah, like they swap.
Yeah, and so
I heard that too.
Yeah, and so they don't, like they're not gonna admit that, but if you look at people's, if you go on, you know, professors' websites and you look at their CVs and you see like, oh, this professor at Harvard graduated from Stanford, or this professor at, I don't know, Vanderbilt came from Columbia. Is Columbia an Ivy?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So it's like, yeah, you see that, you know, they're just passing, you know, students back and forth.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you're, but if you do want, like, if that's on the top of your list, like, you always dreamt of being a professor at Stanford, then maybe you might want to go to one of those schools, right? But you want to still be very particular about what program you decide to go into.
Yeah, and I also think you should, I think a lot of us are taught you should want to go to an Ivy League. Like, that's where, like, that should be your ultimate goal. And I say this as someone who growing up was like, oh my gosh, Ivy League is where I want to go. Mm-hmm. But then the more I realized, it's just like, that's one, I wouldn't feel comfortable in that environment. Two, it's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And they actually have a lot less resources for people. Mm-hmm. Three, it's way more competitive. Mm-hmm. And so at this point, I don't want to end up in an Ivy League. Even if I get a job there, like, I would like to apply just to be like, I'm gonna turn you down.
Yeah.
But I don't think I see myself teaching there because it doesn't seem like somewhere I'd want to spend. Yeah,
and
so
they have these super like pompous students.
Yes.
That, you know, would just that just feel entitled to everything.
Your Brett Kavanaugh.
Feel entitled to A pluses, and yeah, when they don't get it, they're questioning you as a professor.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, nobody has time.
And, you know, we talked about our experience as sociologists, but I have friends who have are going into counseling and are going into social work, and it does not matter where you get your school from. So, like, you could go to an Ivy League school, mm-hmm, but no one's going to say, like, oh, yeah, I want to make sure that my count therapist went to Stanford as opposed to the University of whatever. It's like, if you get good reviews, like, there's so many therapists already, like, you're not really going to edge out as a social worker to say, like, oh, yeah, my so, like, you're not going to, a person who was looking for a social worker is not going to say, where did you go to school?
Right.
So, like, also, like Ebony said, like, if your industry is one of those where it doesn't really matter what school you go to, then you have to think about, like, why do I want to go to this program? Why do I want to go to this school? Because not every industry or job really places as high of an emphasis on where you get your schooling from.
Yeah. And in grad school, like, it's not the same as undergrad. Whereas undergrad rankings, I think, are a lot more important.
Mm.
In grad school, the prestige of the university does not dictate the prestige of the department.
Yes.
So the highest ranked universities don't necessarily have the highest ranked sociology programs. You know, and so I think the number one is Wisconsin.
Or Michigan,
mm-hmm, right? And those are not the number one.
They're not Ivy Leagues.
Yeah, they're not Ivies, but they have like the number one program. So mm-hmm, if you want to become a sociology professor, then those are the schools that are like at the top of your list, right?
Yeah.
Not necessarily Harvard.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't think that University of Wisconsin is top. And even for statistics, I think University of Indiana is like one of the tops.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't think.
Yeah.
And then, you know, for computer science, it's like Georgia Tech is one of the top ones. And you wouldn't think.
Yeah.
So also, like Ebony's saying, like, do your research and look at the rankings, and then you'll see, like, oh, ranking works differently for graduate school than it does for undergrad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And number two, make a list of pros and cons. And so aside from the basic generic stuff about ranking, opportunities, etc., what's most important to you? So think about where you can see yourself living for the next year, 2 years, or 5 years, depending on what kind of program you're going into. What kind of people do you want to be around?
Yes.
What kind of weather do you like? How far from family and friends are you willing to be? And one thing that Zelma brought up, like, are you in a relationship? Is this relationship going to be long term?
Mm-hmm.
How straining will that be on your relationship?
Mm-hmm.
How much are flights from your home to this school? Are there direct flights?
How long the flights are?
How long is the flight? Like, there are so many things that you have to consider that may not be immediately obvious to you. You know, because I was actually talking to someone recently who's at a university where there are no direct flights from their university to their home. So it's like they gotta fly to a different city, it's like a 2-hour layover, and then home. You know, and it's like, do you really wanna have to go through that? And it may not seem like that big of a deal initially, like it may not seem like something that you wanna base your decision on, but after being in a program for 3-4 years, you'll be over it.
Or come Thanksgiving and everyone's going home and you're like, oh, I live, you know, I have a friend who started in a school in New York, and she's like, she has to book her flight for December, like, now, because it's Thanksgiving, you know, it's holiday season, it's really expensive, and so you just gotta think of stuff like that, like, budget-wise, how many times can you travel, and if you're long distance, you know, that also changes. Like, one is not every couple has the option of moving with you.
Yeah.
So if you're going to do long distance, like, think about, are you, you know, willing to risk? Because it is a risk of, like, seeing, okay, are we going to, even if you've been dating someone for a while, like, is this going to work and be sustainable when we're not living in the same city? Because not our relationships, some relationships require a lot of cultivating and a lot of time spent together and a lot of, and it seems really doable at first, speaking from someone who's done long distance. But, you know, 1 month in, 2 months in, it gets really, really hard. So definitely things to think about in your pros and cons list, because grad school is not just, like, school shouldn't be your entire life. So you really got to think, like, especially for my people who are people of color, my people who are LGBT, like, are you going to be in a place that you're going to have a community?
Yeah.
So are you going to be the only Black person in the entire town? Are you going to be the only Latino person? Are you going to be able to find any other restaurants that kind of cater to the food that you're used to? Are you going to have feel comfortable? So stuff like that, you got to think about.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that I didn't consider when I was applying to schools, but that when I started going on interviews and visits, I realized was super important, is, like, some of these schools are in small towns, and the school is the only thing in the town. Like, that's the biggest attraction, right?
Yep.
And those are towns that are usually filled with a bunch of stuff for undergrads, you know? So you go to the bars, everybody's 21.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and so as a grad student, it's like, you're a student, but you're also an adult. And so do you want to be in a town where it's so small and you are the, well, there are very few people of color, and then also there aren't very many amenities for, like, people that are your age, you know? And so I remember I was going to look at it, going to interview at a school in Florida, and I was like, oh my God, I can't be here. Yeah. I was like, I remember my dad telling me when I was going on a visit, he's like, yeah, it's so fun down there. Mind you, my dad was in college in the 80s. Also,
yeah,
so he's like, yeah, it's so fun down there, you have so much fun, it's a party town, and da da da. And but it's like,
but
he was also a football player, so it's a party town for a football player, and not for, like, some Black girl in grad school, like, where there were 2% Black people in the town, and they are all on the university football team. Like, no, I don't. I mean, I'm being facetious. I'm exaggerating, but still, like, that's what it looked like, you know?
Yeah.
And no, so those are things to think about.
Especially if you're single.
Yeah.
Like,
if you're, yes.
Dating pool wise, because we have a friend who is single and moved to a small town. And it's really geared towards undergrads. And it's like, do you really want to date 22-year-olds?
Yeah.
Or have to drive 2 hours?
Are you open to interracial dating?
Yes.
You know, because if you go to a town where there are very few people of color, like, that's what you may be forced to do.
Those are your options. Or if you're gay, lesbian, bisexual, do you want to date the one other gay, lesbian, bisexual person?
That every other gay, lesbian person has dated already.
So things that you have to think about, because
quality of life.
Yeah, quality of life is really, really, and don't downplay or have people say, like, well, you'll be too busy with school. No.
No, you won't. You won't. Maybe for the first year or two.
Yes.
And then after that, you're going to want something else, you know? And so I guess one last thing that I'll say to this point is also think about finances. Being in grad school in, say, a small southern state is going to be very different than being a grad student in New York City.
Yes.
Like, the cost of living is very different.
Yes.
And I mean, grad school, like, while you're in grad school, you're going to be broke.
Uh-huh. You know? Even if you don't pay tuition.
Yeah, even if you get funding, like, you're going to be broke. And so, if you go to school in a very expensive city, you're going to be struggling.
Yes.
And, I mean, you're going to struggle regardless, because the cost of living is pretty good where we are, and I still struggle.
So look up cost of living.
Yes, make sure you pay particular attention to that. If you can, try to save a little bit before you get there. Also, you know, something that I've had people ask me questions about is, like, whether or not you can work, like, whether or not you should have a job, or can have a job. And I think that that's varied depending on the rigor of your program.
Yes.
Some programs are more, more intense than others, and are more micromanaged than others. And so if you're, like, for instance, our program is pretty micromanaged, and so it would be hard to get away with having a job, I think, like a full-time job or something like that without your advisor knowing about it.
Or being upset.
Or, yes, yes, finding out and then being upset about it. Because to them, your attention should be on your research and your work and stuff. And so if you are working, then to them, it would look like you aren't working as hard. Even if it's like you're working because you have to, like you literally maybe have to support a family or something like that. They don't really understand that and they don't really care. So think about the cost of living in the place.
Yes.
So think about, prioritize your quality of life.
Yes.
Think about what you need. You know, can you live in snow? Can you live
in humidity?
Yeah,
that's for real. Because if will you have a car? Do you have to use public transportation?
What is the public transportation like in the place that you live if you don't have a car?
Because you came from good.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, so I'm from LA. The public transportation is much better. Not the best, but it's
better
not Chicago, but it's better. Yes, and then I moved
here
for grad school, did not have a car.
It's terrible.
The public transportation here is trash.
It is terrible. Like,
sometimes buses would just not come.
Yeah.
You know, or lived about 15 minutes from campus, but it took me an hour and a half to get here on the bus because there are so few routes.
Yep.
And so that was torturous. That was torturous, and I would not wish that on anybody. So think about that. It's not something that I considered.
Or you don't anticipate
anticipate. You just think that, especially coming from a city, you just think that every city's like yours.
No, that's true, yeah.
Yeah, it's not. Okay, so third on the list. Master's or PhD?
Yes, very important question.
How do you decide?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so I'm a little bit, so I guess I'm just going to reiterate what was told to me, right? So most PhD programs are funded.
Yes.
The ways that you receive the funding are different. So some are, you might get a research assistantship, you might get a graduate assistantship that involves you like working with some office on campus, like say a diversity office, you might be their grad representative, that's a grad assistantship. A research assistantship is like you're doing research for whoever the principal investigator is. So it might be you're a faculty advisor, it might be a different faculty advisor, you might just be working on under a institute and you could be the research assistant for that, and then you receive your funding that way. Or a teaching assistantship where you teach and
TA.
You teach and then you get your funding that way. So I know people that are, so the program that we're in is research assistantship based. So everybody is funded, everybody that's admitted into the program is funded, and you become a research assistant for your advisor and you are paid that way. I know people that are in programs where they're funded through teaching and they so you start, maybe, like, I think that for the program that I'm thinking about, you get funding your first year, and then second year you start teaching. And then you teach all the way through, teach different, like, you know, maybe a class or two each semester, and then that's how you're paid. I think that the difficulty with that, though, is, like, securing summer funding. Sometimes that's hard because you don't always want to be teaching during the summer. And then I do have a friend that's funded through like a GA ship, which is the graduate assistantship. And I really like the graduate assistantship program. But that's also because I think that depending on what you want to do career-wise, if you are on the RA track and you want to go into academia, that could help you to, you know, publish more. There are different types of academic jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So some are, say for instance, like your liberal arts university. So like say a Mills College versus a Harvard, right? So Mills College is a liberal arts university, very teaching oriented. So if you're going to apply to be a professor at a university like that, you need teaching experience. So entering a PhD program where you're funded through teaching would be good for you ultimately because you'll have tons of teaching experience when you leave. if you want a job at a research-oriented university like a Harvard, or, you know, you can look up lists of R1 schools online.
Yeah, or even a large state school.
Yeah, most big schools that you can think of off the top of your head are probably research-oriented universities.
Yes.
If you want a job at one of those, then the research assistantship would probably be the best route for you to go. So you should probably enter a program like that, because you'll get a lot of research experience. You may have opportunities to publish and things like that, which would ultimately help you to secure that job. Now, if you want a job outside of academia, like maybe you want to work in in administration in the university, like maybe you want to direct some kind of research program or institute, or you want to direct like a diversity office or something like that, then entering a program where you're funded through graduate assistantships might be better, because your GA ship would be working in one of those offices, so you would get experience that way. This is something that I did not know when I was applying to grad school. It was just like, get funding, you know, apply to the programs that would get you funding. I didn't understand the difference between all the assistantships. I didn't understand why they mattered for your career. But yes, that is something that I would have liked to know starting out. Okay, so that's the PhD stuff. Again, they're funded, and so a lot of times that is the biggest incentive to go into a PhD program. Also research. So you, as a PhD student, regardless of how you're funded, you're going to be doing research. You have to do, sometimes, depending on the program that you go into, you may have to do a master's thesis. You definitely have to do a dissertation. So you're going to be doing research. If you enjoy research, if you have something that you would like to know, or you'd like to study a population or something like that, go into a PhD program. Master's programs, they vary. They don't always have a research component, but I've heard that some of them do. Like, you can either do, like, the capstones vary. You can either do a thesis or
an internship, which was applied, or research, which is if you want to do academia.
Yeah. Okay. So if you are not super interested in research, or if you kind of are, or if you just aren't sure yet whether or not you want to make the commitment to a PhD program, go the master's route. Master's programs are not usually funded. I do have a friend that was funded, but she, I think, developed a relationship with the advisor or something like that. I'm not 100% sure how she did that, but it is very rare. So you will be paying for that.
Yeah, or low funding. That's yeah. Because I was funded, but it's definitely different.
Yeah. So, and then also, there was one of the, oh, and also time commitment. So that's something that to think about, too. Like, if you, so what another benefit of a PhD, depending on what kind of program you go into, is that a lot of them include a master's. So you will, for instance, like the program that we're in, right? So after 2 years, you get a master's, but you're in a PhD program. So it's like, I would not advise this necessarily, or I'm going to say it, but don't say you heard it from me. If you want to get a master's, if you're unsure about the PhD, but you get into a program, you can technically leave after 2 years, and then you'll have had a master's for free without having had to pay for it. Now, again, I would not suggest gaming the system that way, but that is a thought. You know, you will have a degree that you didn't necessarily have to pay for. But PhD programs, on average, are about 5 years, so that's a commitment. Maybe less if you, I don't know, expedite it or fast-track it, but oftentimes more. Our average is about 5.5-6 years. I know programs, like I think Berkeley is like 11 years on average, you know, so these are things that you should pay attention to. And these are questions that, like, if you know someone that's in that program, or find someone that's in that program, you know, just go to the university or go to the department's website, find their students, email a student, you know, and you can ask these types of questions that you wouldn't find. Just are answers that you wouldn't find on the website. Like, no, you're not going to find on the website, hey, by the way, people take about 11 years to finish our program.
Yeah.
No, you wouldn't find that information. You would just be in it, and you'd be like, oh my God, I've been here forever.
Yeah.
You know? So make sure that you ask, you know, those kinds of questions.
Yeah. And just to add, so if you're doing a PhD program, and they are mostly funded, but not all programs fund for all your years. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I got accepted to universities, and they only guaranteed me funding for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
And then they said afterwards it would be on a year-by-year basis.
Year-by-year?
Mm-hmm.
Based on what?
Based on the availability of funding.
Oh, heck no.
So, like, you definitely want a PhD program that's funding you for all your years? So it's something you have to ask and say, what does the funding look like? And if they tell you it's year by year, run away, because that means it's not guaranteed.
Yeah, which means you probably won't get it.
And yeah, which means you probably won't get it. Or if you do, it will be like very small.
Yeah.
And then, so I did a master's and a PhD. I actually also got the master's along with the PhD in this program. The reason I did a master's is one, I went to like a very small undergraduate university, and so I didn't feel like my application was very strong and my GRE scores weren't that great. And so in my thinking, I went to a master's program because they are easier to get into than a PhD program. I didn't have any research experience. I didn't have any publications. I didn't work with any professors. I went to a liberal arts school. It wasn't research geared at all, and I didn't think I could apply to a research geared PhD program with my application. So I did a master's program. It was funded through a TA ship. So I was a TA. That's how I got funding. But the funding I got was very, very small. So I actually got $1,000 a month. And wow. That was full funding. Like, that was like the highest you could get. There were actually people who got less than
Did
me.
Did people work?
Yes. So people worked.
Yeah.
So I worked and I did school. Mm-hmm. Because like you can't live off $1,000. And so I definitely, that's something, if you can't devote all your time to school, I definitely would suggest doing a master's too, because a master's would be more flexible with you working and doing school. A master's also 2 years, so you know, it will take a little longer if you do want to get a PhD, but I would suggest a master's for two reasons. One, if you still want to work, if you're a parent, if you don't have as much time, if you have other commitments, and two, if your application isn't that strong, if you look at the GRE requirements, if you look at if they're asking you for publications, if they're asking you for research experience, and you don't have any of that, then maybe building that at the master's level will help you and increase your likelihood of getting into a PhD program.
Yeah.
And that's the path that I did, and it worked for me. But there are some people like Ebony who went straight from undergrad to a PhD program.
Yeah.
So there's definitely two different ways you could do it.
Yeah. If you're listening to this and you are in undergrad and you have time, I would suggest jumping on some kind of research experience if you want to get, if you ultimately want to get a PhD. Because it's like if you're not a parent, or if you don't have like financial obligations or dependents or anything, and you can afford to be broke for 5 years, and you think that one day you might want to get a PhD, I would say just do it.
Yes.
Like, I would say just apply to as many, I guess that's something we should talk about too, apply to as many programs as you can afford. I know that applications are expensive.
Yeah.
I was looking yesterday to try to, I was trying to actually convince someone to apply to our program, and I think it's $89 or something like that. Now, if you're a part of a, so I was in McNair when I was an undergrad, and they gave us, I want to say, like, 4 fee waivers or something. But I think I applied to, like, 11 schools.
Oh, my gosh.
I think I applied to, like, 10. Maybe I applied to 10. I want to say I applied to at least 9 schools. I know that.
I applied to 2.
I casted a wide net, and I think I casted such a wide net because, well, one, in McNair, like, they really push you, you know, they tell you all of these things that you need to do. So their thing was apply to at least 10 schools. I think that ultimately at the last minute, some stuff happened with one of my recommenders. So I wasn't able to make one of the application deadlines. Like, I missed it. So I think I applied to like 9 and had to pay for 5 of them.
Oh my God,
right,
a lot.
Which is like $400.
That's crazy.
So apply to as many programs as you can. And I didn't know what I was looking for. Like, my only thing was that I wanted to apply to programs that had at least one black professor at least, and at worst, at minimum, one professor of color in general.
Oh, see, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, I was like, I was looking at the faculty and I'm like, if it's all white, I'm not applying there. Like, what? I'm gonna be, what? What kind of culture is that? Mm-hmm. You guys didn't even think, like, first of all, sociology is all about social inequality, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of variation. There's like org soc, but we don't care about those. So, sociology, for the most part, is about studying social interactions, social inequality. If you study social inequality, why do you not have any people of color in your department?
That's a good
point. I don't want to be a part of that. So that was like my baseline you know, it was like, okay, I'm looking at all the pictures, and obviously race is not always readable, but so what? I'm looking at all the pictures, and I can't see people of color, you get X'd off the list, period. I'm not applying there. Mm-hmm. So think about what you need. Like, if you're okay being the only blank in the department, cool. If you're not, don't do it to yourself, because you'll be miserable, you know? So, yeah, apply to a bunch of stuff, figure out what you need financially, figure out what experience you have, research experience and all that stuff. If you have research experience, or if you still have time to get some, do that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No. I think, well, for me, the most important thing for me was I couldn't leave the city I was in, mm-hmm. because I had a significant other, mm-hmm. and we were really, like, we got engaged, yeah. in high school. I mean, we got engaged when I was getting...
Like, wait, I didn't know that.
No, we got engaged when I was doing my master's, and so I couldn't leave. Yeah. It didn't make sense.
Yeah.
So I only applied to two programs. One, which was a driving distance from where I was living, which would be 3 hours. Yeah, it was the state university, and the other one was in the city that I was living in. Actually, no, I did three. Two in the city I was doing, but one in a different field, epidemiology.
Epidemiology?
Uh-huh, and I got accepted to that one. Yeah, it's actually higher, it's the number one epidemiology program.
Wow, yeah. So why were you thinking that?
I wanted to do something health, and I was very limited, and so like, telling people, like, it's really real. Choose what's the priority, because mm-hmm. that will dictate. And like, that was the only reason I was doing epidemiology. I was like, okay, I want something health, and I need to stay in this city. Mm-hmm. What are my options? Okay, sociology, social work, or epidemiology. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to do social work, so I did sociology and epidemiology. Mm-hmm. Got accepted into both, but ultimately, when it came down to money for me, mm-hmm. and the sociology program offered me more money than the epidemiology program. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason I chose it.
Yeah, money's a big deal.
Yeah, so some people are like, oh no, it was my calling, it was my thing. I'm being very real with you guys and telling you, like, it was all money, and it was all I can't leave.
Yeah.
And so if that's the same for you, because I know a lot of people who are in points of their lives where maybe you're thinking about graduate school a little later than undergrad. Maybe you've been in the workforce. Maybe you're thinking about going back to school in your later 20s, earlier 30s, and you're already kind of settled and established, and you don't have the flexibility to move around a lot, then look at the programs in your city, mm-hmm. and see what comes closest to a degree that will let me do what I want to do. So epidemiology would let me work in a health setting, and that's what I wanted to do. And I'm glad with my choice of sociology, but I also think I could have been happy in epidemiology. And
that's
so
interesting. Oh, but I wouldn't have made it.
Yeah, that's true. So, like, you know, we're giving you both of our perspectives and both of the reasons why we chose, and I'm really glad that Ebony and I are both talking about it, because we both had very different experiences. Her coming from undergrad, me coming from a master's program where I was in the workforce and then went back to school, me having to stay in the city because I was engaged, and Ebony having the flexibility at that time to move out of state. And so just think about where you are, what you're willing to sacrifice, because grad school is about sacrifice. You have to sacrifice something.
Yeah.
Whether it's money, whether it's career mobility, whether it's being close to your family, like, think about that. You may miss birthdays. You may miss mm-hmm. babies being born.
You
may
miss all of those.
Yeah,
things.
You'll
yes.
miss important life things with your family and friends. And so ask yourself, are you okay, like, not being there for that? And if you're not, then maybe think somewhere closer to home, and then choose from, narrow down your list from there. But it's definitely, like, you have to think about a lot of, the first thing is, do I want to go to grad school? The second thing is,
what kind of degree?
Yeah, what kind of degree? And the third thing would be, like, what's most important to me at this moment? And then from there, narrow down, like, what program, master's or PhD, mm-hmm. can I really take off from not working? And if so, then, like, that will help you know, like, how much funding do you need? Because for me, that was my main priority, was I need to be funded for as much as I can for as long as I can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I kind of, next we were going to talk about funding. I know I talked a lot about that.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple of things. So loans are possible.
Mm-hmm.
We all know, mm-hmm. right? You know, if you're listening and you've gone to college, you've probably taken out some loans.
Yeah.
And I, as someone who was warned about loans and scared away from loans growing up, I am much less scared now. You know, I think that if it's going to make, because ultimately I'm about quality of life, right? So if you're going to avoid loans because you don't want debt, but then you're going to be miserable and struggling and, you know, barely eating and all of that, I don't think that's worth it.
No.
I don't think that's worth it. And then also think about the fact that you're in grad school, you're going to get a job. Now, will you always be guaranteed the exact job that you want? No, but you're going to get a decent paying job. You're going to be able to make your loan payments. You'll be fine. So that's an option if you enter a program that's not fully funded. And then there's also fellowships.
Mm-hmm.
So fellowships are there. They're very, very, very competitive.
Yes.
But it's still important to apply, right? Mm-hmm. Everything's competitive. Getting into grad school in the first place is
competitive. That's true.
And so if you're going to apply to grad school, you might as well apply to some fellowships. And even if you don't get in, it's good practice because there are different ones, different forms at various points in grad school. So you can apply to some, like say at the same time that you're applying to, at the same time that you're applying to grad school, you could apply to fellowships. And then it would be attached to your admission or whatever. You would get it when you start. There are others that are attached to like different research phases. So I'm talking specifically about PhD programs right now. So, you know, you could apply, there's like pre-dissertation grants where you would apply for maybe your master's thesis or something like that. And then they would, you know, give you that money to help with your research, or maybe there's like a living thing. I'm not 100% on how they all work, but they exist. And then there are dissertation grants that will help to fund your dissertation. And so there are some that are national, there are some that are university specific, there are some that are discipline specific, there are even like merit-based ones or identity-based ones,
yeah,
or like race-based ones.
Uh-huh,
ones
like, or women. LGBT.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's money out there. You have to do your research and your homework, but, you know, it can happen. And then, like Zelma said, you know, maybe even working while you're in school.
Even part-time. I did two part-time jobs. Mm-hmm. So one was nannying, which, you know, allowed me to work, like, 3 days a week. The other, I worked at an eye doctor's office.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I worked 3 days a week. So it was, like, 6 days, but for, like, only 3 hours at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So it allowed me to do classes. And then I was really intentional about the class times that I chose.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, sometimes I took a class. I took a sociology of food class I was not interested in, but it allowed me to work and do it. And so, like, if that's what you want to do. And there's also hybrid programs where you do, my sister did, you do half online, half in a classroom. It allowed it allowed her to work full time, and then she did online, and then she did the classroom in the weekends. Or you can do all online, which some of my friends do, and you know, online isn't bad. Some people have this stigma that an online, there are some programs where online is you can do it online. There are some programs like counseling or sociology where you can't do it online. You really have to think about what it is that you are able to do at the time. What ultimately is your goal? Like, do you want a job or do you want a degree? If you just want a job, then just do whatever it takes to get that job. Where you go to school doesn't matter. What type of program doesn't matter as much. It's just the degree.
Yeah, like you just need a master's or you just need a PhD.
Yeah,
that's getting a sense of that. And I would say, you know, that ties in really well, I think, to the next point, which is reach out to people and ask important questions. You know, so you cannot go wrong. I think that there is, you know, there's a fear or some kind of hesitancy or insecurity there oftentimes. I know that before applying, I didn't reach out to people, but after I applied, I did. And if you reach out, and then a few of the schools that I went to visit, I would not have visited or even applied to the schools had I spoken to current students. Because when I went on the visit, you could tell that the students were miserable and I was just not interested in going, right? So I could have saved that $89 and not applied to that school. I mean, granted, I would have applied to a different school because you want to cast a wide net again. But, like, I mean, there's so many things that you could learn from current students if you ask the right questions. And they might just tell you the truth, you know? Like, ask them, like, oh, are you allowed to work? Oh, how are you funded? How open to this particular research topic is the department? Like, are the faculty in the department? how good of a fit do you think that my research agenda would be in this department, et cetera, et cetera. You can ask what it's like to live in that city. You know, how did you go about navigating the city? Were you able to make friends? I mean, there are just so many questions that you could ask, and you could gain so much information from these folks. And then they could ultimately just be people that become a part of your network, you know, because you never know. Like, apparently when you're applying, when you're trying to get tenure as an academic, you have to get like letters of recommendation from people outside of your immediate network. And so those people could ultimately become a resource for you down the line. I know that if people reached out to me and asked me questions, I would respond to them. So,
yeah,
you know, it's important to do that. And you can get more information or expand on the information that we're giving you now.
And what I did is, and I was really scared of doing this because I was like, there's no way they're going to want to talk to me. But every graduate program has a graduate director. Mm-hmm. And I emailed the graduate directors and I was like, can I meet with you just to talk about the program? Mm-hmm. It wasn't, and they, all the ones I've met were really nice.
Yeah.
And they were like more than happy to talk to me about it, more than happy to set up a meeting. And it was, I didn't feel like I had to be like, yeah, I'm applying this fall. I was just like, I would like to know more. They gave me a lot of information. I told them I needed to get funding. They gave me the names of people who are in charge of that, because each school also has a person in charge of funding. And so if you don't know, like me, I didn't have a lot of people who went to PhD programs, so I didn't have a lot of people who I could ask. So I had to go to the school itself. Mm-hmm. And now, like, I'm more than happy to be that role to people. Yeah. So
if you're listening, yeah, and, you know, you're like us, you didn't know anybody in a PhD program,
yes,
consider us a resource. You know, we're a community. Reach out to us, ask us questions, we will answer them. So those are all of our tips. Again, reach out to us, we hope that you are going to apply. If you're considering it, don't hesitate. Yes, go forth and conquer. Also, I will be out of town next week. We won't have an episode for next week, but we will be back the week after.
Use this as a time to catch up, yes, on all our past episodes.
Yes.
But we'll have a good episode in a week.
If you have any questions for us, always feel free to email us at woke.ishpodcast@gmail.com. Even if it's not about sociology, but about grad school in general, we also have contacts. Maybe we can send them to your way. I know people who did law school, medical school. So this may apply some to what you're doing. This also may apply to looking for a job, in terms of things to think about if you want to make a move for a job, in terms of asking for pay, what you need to prioritize. As always, follow us on Instagram at Wokish Podcast. Send us a DM if you have any questions, any topics, any feedback. We hope all of this was helpful. I know this is something I would have liked,
yeah,
to someone to talk to me. And if you're not interested in grad school at all, we hope that you got a little bit more information about this. Maybe share it with someone who you know is thinking about grad school. Mm-hmm. Or maybe this will inspire you to think about, you know, maybe, yeah, I do want to go back to school and I'm going to save this podcast for when I'm ready. Yeah. So,
yeah, whatever it is, we're here for you.
Yes.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.